So I was teaching a retreat recently, and a week-long retreat, and was with co-teachers that I know well and experienced people I love. And at one point during the first full day, I sort of like we were having a meeting, and I sort of interrupted it, like for like a public service announcement. And what I said to my fellow teachers was like, just as a reminder, if you're hating yourself or humanity, remember that it's the first full day of retreat, you know? And the most experienced, the lead teacher, she turned to me and like, thanks. Yeah, like, oh yeah. And I say it because some of you are new to retreat, and some of you have sat many, and there's a way in which it's very easy to actually forget, even if we're quite experienced, the kind of the rhythm and the arc, the trajectory of retreat. And so this is like kind of notoriously peaks and valleys, emphasis on the valleys kind of day. And so it's important to like have some context for that. And so my suggestion is just to kind of hold off on coming to any conclusions about your life and its prospects and the fate of civilization. Whereas, like, emotions are very, like, we can kind of discern the beginning and end of emotions. Like, moods arise and pass away in a much more subtle, almost some undetectable way. And the fact about that is that because we don't actually sense the onset of the mood as this kind of discrete event, it's this slow process of being enveloped by it. We don't know that we're in a mood. And the first day of retreat usually has a certain kind of mood to it. And so I say this just to so that you can be awake to that. And it's like when we're not aware that we're in that, it just becomes our life becomes that mood. Life becomes that mood. The first day of retreat is intense. Life is intense. It's hard. And there is this very deep bias to associate good practice with pleasantness. Like, we all kind of know that's not the case, but there's something in us that's like always has this kind of like barometer, like how pleasant is this? That is determining the value of what's happening. And that is a real kind of basic confusion about what we're doing. But it's a confusion that is very well subscribed in popular culture. And you know, when meditation is advertised, there's like butterflies and babbling brooks, right? And Buddhas, you know. But I was listening to a a talk from Jesse Vega Frey, lovely teacher in Hawaii, and he said his new his new motto for practice was come for the peace, stay for the war. So I don't know how many people came for the peace, yeah. But here we are, right? And this is not like an intrusion into practice. This literally is it. We are learning, like, truly, what is it actually like to be human? And that question is seems so obvious that we can just dismiss it. Like, what is it actually like? Beneath are, like, the elaborate ideas we have about happiness, about suffering, about who we are, about what a good life would be, about what we want, about what we hate. Like, what is it actually like moment by moment to be human? And I don't actually feel like you can answer that question without doing something like what we're doing. Life is just moving too fast, and in the throes of our desire and getting, and sometimes the desires being met or being frustrated, like with all of that movement, it's very hard to actually see what it's like moment by moment. And so here we really dramatically simplify so that we can actually know, maybe in a totally new way, what is it like to be human? And to make peace with the human condition. To actually make peace with what it's with something deeper than just our own individual conditioning or our own habits, but like we're making peace with the human condition. Now, I don't want to be dismissive, like, of all the goodness and pleasure on the path. In a lot of ways, this practice is about, as one teacher said, like, getting what we really want, you know? And what I would say is that we can each fill that out for ourselves, but we've often kind of been we haven't been greedy enough about what kind of peace we want. Yeah. What's possible for humans. And there are many, like, yeah, very beautiful fruits of the path, and different kinds of pleasures, and you know, the kind of the, yeah, just in part the pleasure of, like, of having a path to walk. That's something that Gil said, like, once, one of the guiding teachers here. He said, like, I'm just so glad to, like, have a path to walk. I don't even really care how I'm doing, you know? And when we really, like, connect in with practice, there is this just delight in, like, I'm just, come what may, there's a path to walk, and my life feels practicable, you know? And that is very relieving for the heart. there's the kind of pleasure of the mind as it gets more unified and gathered, and we sort of gather up the pieces of attention, and it feels like the attention gets glued together, and just that is there's a lot of pleasure. This is like there's a whole paths of the path of samadhi, of the unification of mind. Like there is an inherent pleasure in the mind not wanting to go anywhere else, you know. And so the path into the unification of mind is actually letting go of the need to chase. And then the fruit of it is just like, this moment is enough. And we're not foraging for other forms of stimulation. The mind just is glued together. It's unified. That's delightful. There's a sense of wholeness, you know? Like we often come into practice and we feel kind of split or fragmented, or there are little pieces of our behavior or our past or different sides of us, things that we haven't like fully welcomed into our own heart. And there's this process of actually gathering up all the fragments of self, and they like come together. They're like we really bless them with kindness and with understanding. And there's this sense of it's like the past becomes the past. And we've drained some of the kind of electrical charge from some memories or periods of our life or behaviors, and there's just this sense of like of wholeness that here is my life, and we can be increasingly transparent with ourselves and with others. We've like re-understood, reinterpreted the kind of legacy of pain or difficulty. And then it feels like very natural just to be here now. There's the pleasure of being aligned with our own ethical impulses. And so there is a real, there can be ways that we in our lives become estranged from our own hearts, from our own values, from our commitments. And practice is like what I was alluding to last night, like practice is about becoming more and more sensitive to those places where we feel out of alignment. And coming into balance, like beginning for our behavior to like fully express our own deepest ethical intentions, there is a kind of, a wholesome pleasure to this. So there are many forms of delight and pleasure, pleasantness on the path. But it's important to remember, like, not all forms of unpleasantness are created equal. So the Catholic monk, contemplative Thomas Merton, who spent many years in kind of cloistered in retreat, like was asked at some point, like why have you spent so much time in retreat? And his answer was to suffer effectively. That's also something we don't put on the brochure, you know. But it's like, not all suffering is created equally, and there is a kind of wholesome form of friction that happens when we are marshaling energy to do something worthy that is difficult, that's against the stream. So some people, maybe loved ones, people in your lives, friends, they might ask the question like why would you go on retreat? You know, like culturally, like the idea of just sitting still, it really is like it's just insane, you know? And so people have the question, like, why would you do that? Why would you do that to yourself? But my question really is like, what do people think that they're avoiding by not sitting on retreat, you know, by not becoming quiet? Like, if I thought there was a way out that didn't involve moving through, I would not be sitting this much. Like, for sure. If I felt like there was like a viable plan B, you know, but I look, like I like scan the culture for like other models of like what a fulfilled, like open-hearted life looks like. And it's just, I don't think we actually get to escape any of the things that we are experiencing here. And so again, it's this gesture of making peace with the truth of the human condition, with these bodies that are like exquisitely sensitive and a heart that aches easily, you know, with the kind of impulse to hold the world still, even though we live completely in a river of change. And that river, as one of my friends says, like that it has no banks. It has no banks, that river of change. And so insofar as we're going to be happy, it will be amidst change rather than despite it. Even though there's such a deep impulse, like this primal fantasy I have of just like getting the conditions of my life right and then just like holding it still, you know. So Kobun Chino says, the more you sense the rareness and value of your own life, the more you realize that how you use it, how you manifest it, is all your responsibility. We face such a big task, so naturally such a person sits down for a while. On the first day of retreat, and sometimes every day of retreat, we're becoming aware of like how much we want conditions to be one way versus another. And that wanting is a very, deep force within our biology that we are like kind of constantly trying to optimize the conditions of our life, like just tweaking things on an almost moment by moment basis, right? It's like, okay, so some discomfort arises, and then it's like we go into problem-solving mode, or there's some opportunity, some pleasure on the horizon. There's dinner coming, right? And it's like, that's going to require some planning, that's going to require some fantasizing, right? It's like we're like just like continually altering like the parameters, and just trying to engineer our way towards pleasure and security. And it's like such an innocent habit, and we want to see how compulsively trying to optimize the conditions of our life actually fatigues the heart. Sometimes there are findings from within in science that I find poignant and I'm not in neuroscience, so I don't have the kind of full context for these kinds of findings. But this is from prominent researchers, and they're describing the phenomena of wanting and liking. And so they write rewards, so like things we pleasantness, rewards are both liked and wanted, and those two words seem almost interchangeable. However, the brain circuitry that mediates the psychological process of wanting a particular reward is dissociable from circuitry that mediates the degree to which it is liked. Wanting is a form of motivation and is generated by a large and robust neural systems that include mesolimbic dopamine. By comparison, liking, or the actual pleasurable impact of consuming a reward, is mediated, and this is the depressing piece, is mediated by, quote, smaller and fragile neural systems. Yeah. The wanting, like, prominent today, right? Even if it's the not wanting, yeah? We really see like the kind of flood of wanting of one kind or another, and it's robust, right? It feels like very primal. And then there's like this very fragile system of actually enjoying or liking, It's like way more fleeting and the authors say fragile. So we want to be aware of this wanting, like the wanting for things to be otherwise. And I won't spend much time on it, but just to ignore, like go through that these, often when we experience things, it feels kind of like we're the first person or the only person in the world to experience it. Like, we know that's not true, but there's a little part of the mind that's like, no, it's worse for me, right? And so it's like really good sometimes to see these old Buddhist texts like from like thousands of years ago, and like you see a list of different kind of experiences being cataloged, and you can be like, oh, yeah, there I am, like, what, 500 BC Northern India, or like Silicon Valley 2017, yeah, there I am, there I am. So Some difficulties just to keep in mind: ill will and aversion, right? Some measure of our emotional life, ill will and aversion, not liking, not wanting. And what we generally say is that hatred can never end well. We have to see that for ourselves, to start to lose some trust in the aversion. There's the greed, the wanting, the kind of like hunger for pleasure, and that's like totally adaptive much of the time. But if all we ever do is chase pleasure, our happiness is like kind of forever deferred. It's a little bit like that optical illusion of like the water on the highway, when it's real hot, and it's like that shimmering, and you're like just kind of chasing that, waiting to land somewhere, like waiting for the pleasure to deliver something that it can't, which is what we want is peace. We want to be freed of the longing, and the pleasure only partially satisfies that. And so this path is actually to begin to undermine the actual mechanisms of that craving. There's sloth, it's traditionally sloth and torpor, fatigue, like the heaviness, and how many people sleepy today? Just as our hands, So we say, sit up straight, keep your eyes open, you can stand, you can focus on the inhale. And it really is like kind of par for the course on the first day. It's often, it's okay. It's okay. On the other hand, there's restlessness, right? And we say, at least you're not tired. That phenomena of like, of waiting, the restlessness, like just there's like a waiting, and this is very endemic to like the human mind generally. Like even sometimes when we're pretty settled practicing, there's this subtle current of waiting. We're like waiting for something. We're waiting for concentration or equanimity or peace, or we're just like, there's this subtle way in which we're making this moment about the next. One instruction I got very early in practice was sit like a dying person. And there are many many ways to understand that and many ways to interpret that instruction. But one of the ways that I took it in was that thought experiment, it undercuts the sense of like the promise of the future. And it brings in like just the poignancy of one's life, of being alive. Like it feels so natural to be alive, but it's like this like unfathomable like miracle that one was ever born. And then the last is doubt. And the mind that gets kind of foggy and starts asking like the big questions, like, can I do this? What am I doing? What, you know, it's like, and it's said that like doubt often like masquerades as like discerning wisdom, you know. Yeah, basically Max and I just say, trust us. Not in like a culty, weird way. But just kind of like, yeah. Let's just keep going. Yeah. Yeah. This is Norman Fisher. He says, it's hard being a human. There's a lot to it. There really is. So I want to say in conclusion, let's all agree to accept the reality that we're not going to be able to do a very good job of this. There's too much to do. Isn't it a relief to know that it's not going to work out? And you can just forget about that to start with. You're not going to get it right. You're not going to get it perfect. Well, don't worry. Just remember that there's no hope. But the important thing is, despite this, and recognizing and embracing this reality, don't worry about finishing the job or doing it perfectly, but start. You see, start and continue. This is the thing. You can really trust that if you will start and if you will continue with commitment, that will be enough. So we are practicing opening the heart amidst the imperfection of being human. Of actually using the imperfection as a way of softening the heart. Now, in this process, it's like one of my teachers, Shinzen Young, he said, like, it's like being kneaded, like dough, you know? And this experience of like opening to imperfection is a lot like being kneaded like dough, you know. It's like it's intense, and we should be able to feel like, oh, something is being softened in me. Something is being softened in me. The fabric of my being is like, it's being softened. This is like the incredible, like beautiful thing about when we meet imperfection with open-heartedness and equanimity. There's all this interest in mindfulness, and some scholars and researchers like I've emphasized that the equanimity piece sometimes is left out of the mindfulness. And so this is Sarah Lazar and her colleagues. She writes, equanimity is a state and a dispositional tendency that can be developed over time through contemplative practice. Equanimity transforms our sensory, perceptual, and cognitive emotional systems to widen our perspective on experience, to more readily engage sensory information, and more efficiently disengage evaluative and emotional reactive behaviors when appropriate. Generally, this transformation is more gradual than the development of enhanced present time awareness. So mindfulness often is defined as a kind of a combination of moment by moment present time awareness and something like equanimity. And the moment by moment awareness that we can develop that more quickly is what she's claiming than the equanimity. But retreat is about the cultivation of equanimity. We're nurturing that as we sit, as we walk, as we go about our day. And so we're widening the perspective because suffering is a very claustrophobic experience, right? You know that? It's almost like the kind of attention tunnels down and it's like the world starts to feel very small. Our minds feel very small. And there is the sense of like the spaciousness of awareness that is really collapses. And so we deliberately like widen the attention, the scope of attention, widen the perspective. Like we might look up at the sky or, you know, I remember like gazing at stars one night that I knew were like thousands or millions of light years away, and just like the light hitting my eye was like I was looking at the past, you know. I was looking thousands of years into the past as that light hit my eye, and it was just like the expansiveness, like the space and time, it just like cuts through the kind of melodramas of managing our own little, you know, our own little life. We're more readily engaging like sensory experience. So Max was talking about like not bracing against life, of like assuming a posture that conveys a kind of dignity and openness of like, come what may, here is my heart, you know. And we take that dignified posture and we just let life rush in. And there's this kind of confidence that grows that even though like the intensity of our life is like being buffeted by wind, we trust that nothing inside us will be blown over. And then we disengage some of the evaluative thinking. We soften the judgments of the mind. We soften the body. We remind ourselves like, whatever we're experiencing, it can be the seed of more freedom. Yeah. Now we're approaching, mindfulness is a kind of approach. It's an approach orientation rather than a withdrawal or avoidance. It's an approach orientation. We're approaching our experience. But we're doing it with wisdom and not like, I got into a lot of trouble in my practice by kind of taking like too much of a kind of samurai approach, you know, like I'm going to approach no matter what, yeah. But we have to be innovative and balanced and wise when we do this, especially when we're working with something deep here. So this is Michelle McDonald talking about what she called like karmic knots, where like it's those patterns that like are very persistent that you just see month by month, year by year, maybe decade by decade, this kind of like deeply grooved habits. And she says, we're learning to have that deep, unconditional acceptance. We're not trying to get rid of it. With a karmic knot, if you manage to open to it, try to keep some relationship with the anchor, so the breath or something. The line between accepting it and trying to get rid of it is very thin. That's the definition of a karmic knot. You'll think you're there because you're accepting it, but that's not how it works. That little part of you that wants to get rid of it slips in. You don't see it. And all you're doing is reinforcing aversion by staying with it. I believe our karmic knots are our teachers in this life. We're not going to open up. It's not going to open up unless you truly want a relationship with it. So sometimes I'm practicing and something really, a knot comes up. And I sort of like, I like fake curiosity, you know? It's like, I know I'm supposed to be curious. I know I'm like supposed to be interested and I want to know, you know? But it's really just, I'm faking it. I really just want it to go away, you know. Be sensitive to that, yeah? When it like when is there the sense of like reserve of energy and like genuine interest? Like I want to know this. When that's there, you can kind of like trust curiosity almost more than anything, you know. It's much better than discipline or rules or any, you know, any of that. It's much better. It's like when there is genuine curiosity and it's just like, I want to know. I'm like, I'm tired of this. I want to know. When that's really there, go. You can push yourself. You can do whatever you want. Yeah. But when that curiosity is not there, when we have to be sensitive. We have to be sensitive. So sometimes it really is skillful to back off. Right? We say like there's we're learning to open the heart, but we're also learning like when actually to, we could say maybe close or move away, go back to the anchor, find something settled, open the eyes. Like use the visual field as a way of stabilizing, of feeling grounded. Sometimes the body feels under a kind of some threat, or it's too, we're too aroused in a way to like, for it to feel safe inside. And so it may be useful just to actually bring the attention to the visual field and just to like very gently take in each sight and rest there. Yeah. General suffering. It feels very dense, and ease feels like the wind. As we get stiller, as we get more quiet, we're starting to experience our lives, our bodies, our minds as porous space running through everything. The more still we get, the more it feels like, the more we feel like wind, empty. This is my teacher, Shinzen Young, describing like deep mindfulness. It says, to have a complete experience is to love something to death and to know it to death. Whether it's yourself or any sensory event, big or small. When you love it to death and know it to death, you're too busy experiencing it to make an object out of it. So in a sense, it's not there. But it's not there because you're so busy knowing it that it's more there. It's both more there and less there than normal human experience. A kind of completeness and nothingness at the same time. Sounds paradoxical, ridiculous actually, logically speaking. But I'd have to say that most people, from my point of view, are half alive and half dead. The path to enlightenment is about being completely alive and completely dead at the same time. So knowing it to death is both rich and at the same time vacuous. It's through this affirmation for it to be just as it is that its vacuity, the emptiness, becomes experienced directly. As we start to develop more confidence in our path, and it doesn't have to look like it's your path, it's not mine, it's not even in an important sense the Buddhist path, it's really your path. As you start to have more and more confidence in that, certain anxieties just start to melt away. And I say this because it's relevant for the phase of your life that many of you are in, where there are real questions about identity and accomplishment and becoming something, actualizing plans. And I'm not opposing any of that, but what starts to happen is that there's that our ultimate, we ultimately are placing our hope in awareness and love. And when we do that, how our life unfolds exactly, what goes right and what goes wrong, becomes a little bit less urgent. And that opens a real space. Yeah. It feels very much like we're always arriving at these like forks in the road. You know, it can feel like that in each moment almost, like it feels like we approach some fork in the road, and one way we imagine is right, and the other way is wrong. And there's a kind of burden of like continually approaching all of these forks in the road. But my experience with practice is that a lot of those forks are imagined. Yeah? It feels like this way is to enlightenment, that way is fucked, you know? And we're like living that like a million times a day, you know? And it's like, no, that's not what's happening. And we start to like trust that, okay, I'm actually nourishing the conditions for like a deep well-being. Yeah, like that's what it means to have confidence in our path. It's like things are going right or wrong. There's always something wrong, but there's like a kind of there's a confidence, like I'm actually caring for the present moment in such a way that Thich Nhat Hanh said, we care for the future by taking good care of the present. And this is not like about not caring or like lowering our standards or giving up deep aspirations, but there's a kind of openness and trust in the unfolding of our lives that starts to put the heart really at ease. You know, I don't think anyone grows up to be the person they thought they would be. You know, it's like it's just like we never like fully arrive and land in an identity. Like when we imagine growing up, we're sort of like subtly imagining like landing in a place where we feel completely at home in an identity. Like, I am this. Now I'm grown up, you know? Like, now I've arrived. But there's like always a little bit of alienation from all of our identities. Like they never actually feel totally like a home. And when we begin to know that, it changes how we go about becoming someone. It takes the pressure off. We can still have deep aspirations. We can still have like the wish to achieve a lot. And that sense of like being perpetually lured into the future of like arriving at being someone, we can really let that go. So who knows what we need to learn or what we're here to let go of or how deeply we might love ourselves. And that's the kind of adventure of retreat and life, you know. That insight, our growth, the growing freedom of our hearts, it's always kind of surprising. Just sit for a moment. Thank you. We'll keep going. So, you know, sometimes giving a Dharma talk on the first full day of retreat is it's a little bit like playing handball against curtains. But you guys are doing good. I didn't feel like that. Yeah. This portends good things for the rest of the time. Yeah, pleasure to be with you, and yeah, really feels like a privilege, so thank you.